Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with world-renowned pianist Emmanuel Axe. Emmanuel Axe will be performing a benefit for Literacy Network of Southern Berkshire County, or LitNet, at the Mahewi Theater on Saturday, May 26th at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more at mahewi.org. The Literacy Network's mission is to serve the needs of immigrant and U.S.-born adult residents of Berkshire County by providing free, individualized, one-on-one instruction in reading, high school equivalency test preparation, English for speakers of other languages, and citizen test preparation, and by providing generalized educational support and access to a network of community resources. LitNet honored Manny and his wife Yoko with their organization's Founders of America Award at the LitNet Gala in 2011. The award recognizes individuals whose strength of character and commitment to service have improved lives in the Berkshires and beyond. Both Manny and Yoko embody the promise of the American dream, which is so close to the hearts and minds of LitNet students, the idea that anyone can work hard, achieve their goals, and have a better life in America. As immigrants themselves, both Manny and Yoko experience the challenges of starting life over in a new country, and with hard work, talent, and dedication, they have achieved incredible success in their musical careers. Those are just a few of the reasons why it's an absolute joy to be in conversation today with world-renowned pianist Emmanuel Axe. Welcome, Manny Axe.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
So I guess the question is, to begin with, there's a very special honor for people who live in the Berkshires. Everybody thinks they know everybody. So the people will come up to you, I'm sure, and say, I know Manny. Manny's my friend, you know. It's an astounding honor for you to be one of those people like the former governor and Yo-Yo Ma and yourself. I mean, it really is a great distinction.
Well, it's certainly a distinction for us to be part of the Berkshire community. We feel very lucky and very privileged.
Emmanuel Axe, tell us a little bit about your coming to this country. How did that happen?
Well, we came very, very early on in my life because my parents obviously went through the war in Poland in a city called Lvov, which then became the Soviet Union, where I was born. And they had actually started trying to immigrate since before I was born. And in those days, it took a very, very long time. It was very difficult to get out of the Soviet Union. And finally, by the time I was seven, they managed to get permits to go to Warsaw, which, because they were Polish citizens before the war, they somehow managed to get exit visas. So we went to Warsaw. We spent 3 years there. And my mother found a fourth or fifth cousin named Kurtz, Bernard Kurtz, in Winnipeg, Canada. And they were nice enough to write a letter saying that we will not be an imposition on the Canadian government. And so we got to go from Poland to Canada. From Poland, it was so much easier to move to the West. And we arrived, I guess, on New Year's Day, when I was 10 years old, 1960. And it was an incredible, incredible culture shock, especially for a kid like me, mainly because of all the technology, seeing these amazing cars with tail fins. You probably remember that in those days, they had very long tail fins.
Indeed, I do.
Right? The 1959, 1960 cars. And things like toasters that toasted your bread and the bread came up by itself, and the television and things like it was incredible. And of course, at that age, learning English was quite easy. I didn't speak English before we left, but I really did pick it up in a few months because I was 10 years old. I think that's something natural for kids and something a lot more difficult for adults.
That's an amazing story. So what did your parents do?
My father was a speech and voice therapist. And my mother was, when we were in the Soviet Union, was working, I guess, as just a clerk in a jewelry store.
What about the musical genes? Did they have musical ability?
My father was a lover of music and an amateur singer. So he enjoyed music a lot. And I think had a great sense of what was right and what was wrong in music, but he wasn't really trained so much.
When did you recognize your own talents? When were your talents recognized?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of kids start studying an instrument at the age of seven or so, which is what I did. And I think a lot of kids have talent, but some enjoy it more than others. They stick with it. So that's what I did. I stuck with it. And I think around the time I was 14 or 15, we were in New York by then. We got to New York when I was 12 years old. And I was going to Juilliard Pre-College, you know, the program for kids who play an instrument but are not in college yet. They're in middle school or high school. So you'd go Saturdays for lessons. I guess around the time I was 14 or 15, I decided that I was going to try and make this my life.
So. I'm of the belief, as a longtime musician myself, that either you got it or you don't. I didn't, you do. There's a genetic question here.
You know, this is something really that I think in any field at all, it's going to be very difficult to answer for a long time. I just don't think we know because, well, look at athletics, for example, where you have tremendous talent that's exhibited at a very early age. But the development of that talent is something that's, you don't really know. You just don't know what's going to happen with it.
Yeah, but...
At least that's my impression.
but Manny, don't you think that there is a genetic issue? I mean, that some people really could look at an instrument. I have a friend, Peter, who I've been playing the banjo for 14 years. He said, let me see that thing. He came back an hour later. He played better than I did.
You know? I understand. Yeah, well, you know, I'm around a lot of time with people like Yo-Yo. If there was ever an example of someone who was naturally, you know, predisposed to being a great cellist, you know, Yo-Yo is it. He's also worked very hard at it and continues to do so and continues to develop his mind and his musicianship and so forth. But I do think in his case, the talent was overwhelming. Certainly not in my case. I was not a child prodigy. I had a lot of desire for music, you know, so I liked it. I really don't know, and I don't think we'll know for a long time until people get more information about our brain as to how much is DNA and how much is, you know, the old nature-nurture issue.
Well, who did nurture you?
I suppose my dad was very happy that I liked music and to some degree, you know, made me practice because I was quite lazy. And I had wonderful teachers. I had amazingly kind and excellent teachers when I was young. I had a lady in Lvov for a year. And then when we moved to Warsaw, another lady at the elementary school, which was kind of an elementary school, but also dedicated to music, you know, as an extracurricular thing. And she taught there. And then when we got to Winnipeg, I had an amazing teacher, a lady named Jean Broadfoot, who taught everybody in the neighborhood. But, you know, when you get great, great teachers in the sense that they can make things fun and serious at the same time, that helps a lot.
And none of them, as my Mr. Steiker did, ever kicked you in the shins when you got it wrong?
No, well, not so much. I have to admit, they somehow, I didn't get injured by anyone. And they managed to sort of criticize and encourage all in one. I'm sure you know and you agree that there's nothing more difficult and nothing more valuable than a good teacher.
That's right. Now, I have a question for you, Manny, about good teachers.
Yeah.
At what point did your teachers see the talent and say, okay, I need to pass him on to somebody who knows and is better than I am at helping him?
Well, I think the passing on didn't really happen because we moved rather than them. You know, so I actually left before that sort of thing happened. But I think generally they probably felt that I was gifted enough to continue, you know, pursuing this as a profession.
I hear you. But I guess my question really is that I've talked to people over the years. A music teacher says to somebody who's really good, I've taken you as far as I can. Now I got to get you to somebody who could take you even further. Did that ever happen to you?
Yeah, not really, because when I was 14, I went to study with a man named Mieczysław Muntz, a Polish pianist who was teaching at Juilliard. And I stayed with him until I was 25 or so.
Wow.
You know, for 11 years. But of course, he was at one time a great pianist. You know, there was nobody he could have passed me on to that knew so much more, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
But the other part, of course, the other part of anyone's education, I think, is influences from other people. And I was very lucky to be living in New York. I haunted Carnegie Hall. You used to be able to sneak in. There was a door which led to the next to highest level at Carnegie, you know, up on top.
Uh-huh.
And it was always slightly ajar. That wouldn't happen anymore today. It was a fire escape door. And if you went up the stairs to the recital hall, it's hard to explain, but there was a very easy way of getting in. And I heard people, I'm ashamed to say, I didn't pay for the tickets a lot of the time, but I heard every great pianist that passed through New York. That was an education that couldn't be bettered. You know, when you went to hear Rubinstein, Horowitz, Serkin, Richter, Gilels, Ashkenazi, all these people, you would come home and the next morning you'd try to play like one of them. And then you'd hear, two nights later, you'd hear another great pianist say, no, I want to play like him. And two nights later, you'd hear somebody else and you want to imitate him. And sooner or later, you kind of became your own person. It was an amalgam of experiences, but you learned so much from that, from hearing these great artists. So that was, I'm sure that was a major part of my education. Plus my colleagues, you know, when you hear wonderful pianists of your age, you know, and you make friends with them, and you find out how they do things, how they look at things. So all of those influences, I think.
I guess the next question is to ask you a little bit about Juilliard as an institution. It's quite something,
okay.
Isn't it? I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's an amazing place. I guess, as any school, what makes it amazing is not only the people who were teaching there, but the people who are studying there. You know, you always feel that you're surrounded by very, very gifted people. And that's very good. It's a real spur. You know, you realize that you have to practice really hard because everyone else plays better than you do. And you also make lifelong friends who educate you just by being with you. So that, I think, is what makes Juilliard a wonderful place. I think especially now that I'm on the other end of it, I'm actually doing some teaching there, I think it's become a more outward-looking school. Our generation was much more sort of like a horse with blinkers on. You know, you'd practice the piano and go to a piano competition and hope you did well, and if you did, that somebody would hire you for concerts. And now, the kids that I see now, they're so enterprising. They find ways to connect with the dance division or the drama division, and they come up with ideas for concerts and for projects, and it's just amazing the amount of intelligence, creativity, and enterprise that they have. I would say it's a huge improvement, if I may say so.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to public school for a while, and then I spent a year at a place called PCS, which was kind of a truncated academic program to give you more time to practice, and then I went to college.
Where?
I was at Juilliard, but I also went to Columbia.
When you said your friends, that perked up my ears. Anybody you made friends with there that we would know now?
Oh, yes. Garrick Olson, lifelong friend. Fema Bronfman, whom I met when I was 25. James Conlon, conductor, who was a classmate of mine. There were a couple of others that sadly have passed away that would have been very well known at Tanglewood. So, you know, that's an example. You know, and by now, most of the musicians who come to Tanglewood are friends. Of course, Yo-Yo and I were friends, well, since college. We've been playing together, we figured out, for 46 years. So that's that makes me very old, but it's also very nice to look back on.
When did you meet Yo-Yo first?
We first met at the Juilliard cafeteria. we were both eating a tuna sandwich, I think. And he was studying with Leonard Rose at Juilliard. And I was working in Mr. Rose's studio as the accompanist for lessons, you know, because you would get paid for that. At the time, it was $2.50 an hour. But in those days, that was very good money.
Yeah.
So I met Yo-Yo at Juilliard, and we hit it off as friends.
Do you remember that and first conversation?
I wouldn't say so. No, I just remember the tuna sandwich more.
That's great. When did you first play with him, Emmanuel Axe?
I think our first actual concert that we did was, sort of 1969, maybe 1970, 71, something like that. We did a benefit concert for his father was a teacher and had a little thing called a children's orchestra that was run by Rockefeller University in New York. And we did a little thing, a sort of a benefit for that orchestra.
We're talking with world-renowned pianist Emmanuel Axe. He's going to be performing a benefit concert of the Literacy Network of Southern Berkshire County at the Mahewey Theater on Saturday, May 26th at 7:30. You can also go to mahewey.org to find out more about it. Okay, so Emmanuel Axe, let's talk about Tanglewood. You brought us there in your last mention. What's your association? We know, as you know, we play every Tanglewood concert, and we've been doing it for years, and we love it.
Yes.
And we spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your influence or your relationship with that great place.
Well, my first chance to play at Tanglewood was in 1978, I believe. They had a concert with Ato DeVart and the Boston Symphony. And I think a couple of months before the concert, someone dropped out. I don't know who, quite honestly, but they had a pianist scheduled. And I guess for whatever reason, he couldn't come. So the program for the summer, it said pianist to be announced. So I was the pianist to be announced. I guess they couldn't come up with anybody else. So I got a chance to play. Of course, with the Boston Symphony, you know, it was one of the pinnacles of one's life to be able to say, I'm going to play with the Boston Symphony.
That's great.
It was an incredible honor. It was a rainy Sunday afternoon. Ato DeVart conducted. I guess I somehow played decently. I had forgotten my black shoes in New York. And one of the bass players who was not playing in the concerto because the orchestra was reduced, he said, here, take my shoes. They're big enough. So I used his shoes for the concert.
That's a fabulous story.
Well, it was of course, an incredible honor and so exciting to play with this marvelous group. And then I came back with Mr. Leinsdorf, I guess, maybe a couple of years later. Then came once with the Cleveland Orchestra when they were visiting Tanglewood. And each time that I came, the first time I came alone, the second time my wife came with me and we stayed for 3 days or something. The third time, I think Yo-Yo and I did a recital, and then we each played with the orchestra. So we stayed for about a week. And we kept staying longer and longer because we loved it. And finally, we started renting a house and spending summers. So I think we spent about 18 summers there before we thought, well, maybe we really should try and get a piece of land and build a little house. And that's what we've done. And now we're really full-fledged residents. So,
indeed you are. I met you at the Big Y one day.
Yes. We meet at the store. Well, also at Guido's once.
Guido's. Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned wife. Let's talk about wife. Where did you meet your wife, and how did that happen?
We met at music school. We met at Juilliard. And she's Japanese. She came from Japan when she was 12 or so, because her father, who was a biochemist, got a job at Duke University. He had done graduate work in Iowa and went back to Japan and then got a very nice offer from Duke. And so the whole family moved, Yoko's older sister and, of course, her mother and she was 12. And I think she had kind of the same experience I did, because she was young. She picked the language up very, very quickly and was able to just go to school in a matter of months. So then she was a very precocious and wonderful pianist very early on. She won a big music teacher's national competition when she was 17 or so, and then went to Juilliard, and that's where we met.
And how did it happen? Did you bump into her in the hall, or were there tuna fish sandwiches?
Well, no tuna fish sandwiches involved. No, I just, I think I pursued her for a while, and she finally gave in.
Yeah, okay, let's get down to the details. Yeah. Where did you first see her? Where did you first see her? In a class, or did you see her playing the piano?
In the elevator at Juilliard, I saw her carrying some music and tried to strike up a conversation by saying, oh, you're learning this piece, you know, because I saw the piece of music she was carrying. And I don't think she took much notice of me, but then I kept asking her things. And then we wound up in a summer program in Orono, Maine in 1969. And there I had more chance to kind of talk to her more frequently. So,
do you remember the proposal?
The what? I'm sorry?
Do you remember the proposal?
Oh, yes, that was much later. Oh, yeah, that was much later. But we dated for quite a long time. I think we started dating in 1969 and got married 5 years later.
That's not so long.
So it was maybe not so long. Of course, we were still students, and really we had very little income. We couldn't have a household in a way. We really were trying to make ends meet, both of us. But finally somehow managed, and she still lets me back in the house, which is nice.
Yeah. Talk to me about music. You mentioned music. I have a friend who was the librarian, I guess, at Tanglewood for a long time, John Perkel.
Of course, I know John. I know John very well.
Wonderful guy. Wonderful guy. Anyway, I've often wondered about that. That's a heck of a tough job, right? Making sure everybody has the right music.
Oh, yes. The librarians for a great orchestra like the Boston Symphony are truly amazing people. First of all, they have an incredible range of knowledge about pretty much everything having to do with music, but also they're so gifted with their hands. You know, I'm afraid I take advantage of them sometimes. I go and see Wilson, the librarian now, and I used to go see John and ask for various things like, you know, I need these pages, you know, enlarged a little bit, and I need this cut, and I need, you know, just because we became friends, so I took terrible advantage of them. But they have all these wonderful gadgets in the library. You should go sometime just to see. They have a huge electric eraser, because a conductor will have notations, you know, the whole orchestra will have notations, and the next conductor comes along, so they have to erase all the notations from everybody's music. And they have a huge electric eraser that just does it very quickly. It's wonderful to see. So
each conductor who comes in, Emmanuel Ax, each conductor who comes in obviously says a little louder here, a little softer there,
yes,
a little slower.
Yes.
And every single piece of music in that orchestra that's going to be played has to note that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember I have foot and mouth disease quite often. And one of the things I remember was playing with the Dresden Staatskapelle Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
And I was playing a piece of Strauss called the Burlesque for piano and orchestra. And they had very tattered music with all kinds of writing on it, you know, the orchestra. And I'm looking over at the stands, and I asked one of the violinists, why don't you get some clean music? You know, then you could write the stuff that you need to write, because it's covered black stuff. Well, we would, but, you know, these are the parts that Mr. Strauss actually used. So
when you play, do you always use music, or do you know the piece?
No, I rarely use music for performances on my own or with orchestra. For chamber music, I usually do use music. I think it's a convention, I guess. Although I think these days, with all the new music that we're learning, I think it's become a sort of non-issue. You know, so you use music when you need it, and when you don't, you don't. I don't think it matters one way or another very much.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, I can't remember my own name, or I can't remember my kids' names. Now, you have to remember all of these things.
I'm with you. I don't remember anything else. It's just it's just the music seems to stick sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
But I've promised myself that if I ever start really worrying about it, I'll just put the music out and use it.
Right.
You know,
right.
there's no shame in it, and it certainly proves that I can read music, which is good.
We're talking with world-renowned pianist Emmanuel Ax, performing a benefit concert for the Literacy Network of Southern Berkshire County at the Mehewi Theater on Saturday, May 26th at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more at themehewi.org. Roselle and I are going. So let me ask you a question, Manny. Do you go back to the countries of your origins, you and Yoko, at all?
Well, as a matter of fact, we went back. I've been to Warsaw any number of times. But this past November, we went back to what is now Lviv in the Ukraine. Yoko was with me. I hadn't been since I was 7 years old.
Oh, boy.
And it was a sort of a serendipity trip in the sense that there's a man. It's quite a long story, I'm sorry. But
sure.
There is a man named Philippe Sands, who is an international lawyer, teaches at Cambridge. He's written a book called East-West Street, and it's about two people who were born on the same street in Lvov, or actually in Lemberg, which is what it was before the First World War. They were both involved in the Nuremberg trials, and one recommended to the U.S. government that they use the words crimes against humanity, and the other invented the word genocide. And, well, if you have a chance to get this book, it's an extraordinary book, I think. And they were going to make a presentation based on this book. And he came to a concert I did in London and said, you know, I saw you were born there. Are you able to join us for this? And it happened that I was going to be in Europe, and I actually had those 2 days were available. So we went, and I participated with just a couple of little pieces in that presentation, and it was incredibly touching. I met the son of my very first piano teacher.
No.
I met a couple of people who had studied with that lady who were older than me, but they somehow remembered this little kid. You know, I was seven, and they were 15 or 16. It was quite marvelous.
Was it emotional?
Yes, in a way, yes. I mean, I was thrilled to meet these people, but I had no real connection to the city. I think we left too early.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful city.
And how about Yoko? Have you gone back to Japan?
Oh, yes. We've been to Japan quite often. And Yoko, of course, still has a lot of relatives there, a lot of cousins.
Let me shift directions, if I may, and ask you the question of, look, here you are, one of the, if not the top pianist, you know, in the world.
Okay.
But I didn't mean to embarrass you, but it's true, of course. And so my question is, you play with quartets, you play classical music with orchestras. Can you compare for us what it's like to do either of those?
Well, I think playing, you mean playing with an orchestra or playing in ensemble?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, I've always thought that it was sort of the same because it depends, the music dictates the way you should play and the way you should feel. So, you know, there's always a dialogue, whether it's with a big orchestra or just another person like Yo-Yo. There's always a conversation, and you're always aware of everybody else on stage. And then I also quite often just play on my own, all by myself.
Sure.
But when I play my own recital, even there, for a pianist, there's still a conversation because there are several voices going on. There's always a left hand and a right hand. You know, it's never just one voice, like a violin, let's say. So I think I always think about music in terms of how it should sound. And then, obviously, if you're playing with a good friend, there's a wonderful communication. If you're playing with a wonderful orchestra, there's a lot of communication there, too. I don't know. I don't know how to compare them, except you sort of naturally fall into the situation.
Okay, so you're a soloist, you're at Tanglewood, and there's a famous conductor up there.
Yeah.
Tell me about, I've often wondered about what that relationship is like when the orchestra is obviously following the conductor. You have that kind of responsibility also. How does that work?
Well, in my case at least, I think I try to connect with what the conductor would like to do with the piece. We talk about it before, obviously. We have a meeting, you know, the two of us.
Yeah.
And usually it's very smooth, it's very easy, it's very comfortable. The fact is, most of the pieces that we play, there are hundreds of ways to do it. There are hundreds of different approaches for a Beethoven piano concerto. And if you are two decent people, there's no reason you can't agree on an approach for that given concert, you know?
Aha, but what happens when you meet up with one who isn't so decent?
Well, you try to avoid that situation. And most of the time, I have to admit, most of the time, I've been very fortunate. I don't think I've ever had a real clash with a conductor. You know, I think it's usually not a musical clash, but a clash of personalities. I really do believe that. I think I've been lucky to deal mostly with very decent and outgoing people, and I just haven't had issues in that sense.
So who follows who, Emmanuel Ax? Does the conductor follow the pianist or the soloist, or does the soloist follow the conductor?
Well, see, I think that totally depends on the situation. First of all, if I'm playing with Bernard Haitink, who's a great conductor and he's now 89 years old, I have absolutely no desire to tell him how to do anything.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to watch him and do what he would like done. So I think someone like him, he would probably control the pulse of the performance. And there are places, you know, there are places where I slow down or I speed up where he actually has to watch me, you know, and respond to it.
Yeah, yeah.
There are places where I have to do the opposite. It's a give and take. It's like any conversation. If you're talking to someone, there are times when they listen. There are times when you listen. The only trouble comes is if you are talking to someone who doesn't want to listen. That's not good. you try to avoid that.
Talk to me about audience. There you are in the Great Shed or Ozawa Hall or wherever you are, and Carnegie Hall. Is there anything an audience can do to annoy you?
To annoy me? Well, I suppose if there's an incredible amount of rustling, coughing, whispering, that can be a little annoying, but within reason, I think it's usually okay, you know. I think people should come to concerts and listen to them the way they naturally would like to listen. I think the more you impose artificial limitations, actually the more. Well, I'll give you an example. One of the things that I notice is that sometimes you finish a movement of a piece, and instead of applauding or moving around or whatever, people keep very quiet because the next movement's coming. And then you start the next movement, and then everybody relaxes and rustles around. So it would be much more pleasant if the movement finished, then they had a conversation or rustled around or did whatever. And then when the next movement started, we would all be attentive again. So I think sometimes we impose artificial barriers on concert behavior that shouldn't really exist.
So, for example, every once in a while you go to a concert and somebody who is not really, you know, familiar with the protocols will start to applaud between movements.
Which of course, that's one of my pet peeves, because, of course, the historically correct thing to do is to applaud between movements. It's wrong not to.
Got you. Well, maybe you should stand up there at the beginning of the concert and say, by the way, if you want to applaud between movements, you can.
Well, I've written about it. You know, I've actually written letters about it and have posted a couple of things on a website. Yes, if Beethoven had heard the Emperor Concerto played by his student Hiller, and the first movement finished and he got no applause, he would have been mortified and shocked.
I love
so,
it.
So, you know, I would love to get that message out more, and I do try. If somebody starts applauding, I immediately turn and nod and say thank you.
Really?
I don't just sit there and pretend it doesn't happen. So,
you know, the psychology.
Of course, it's also nice when people applaud at the end. Both are nice.
The psychology of an audience is interesting, because do you ever think about the fact that, you know, some wives have probably dragged some husbands to sit there, and they are behaving in a what can only be called a passive aggressive, you know, fashion.
Well, if there's anything I can do to overcome the distaste, I will try very hard.
So let's talk a little bit about the literacy network of Southern Berkshire.
Yes.
You know, for years I've been kidding around with them. I write a column in the Berkshire Eagle, and I always write about Murray.
I know we read you,
And I always write about Murray the dog. And I always say Murray the dog learned how to speak English, you know, at the literacy network of Southern Berkshire. And they seem to like it, so I've been doing it it for years. And in fact, people have come up to me on the street and said, "Is that dog really speak English?" And I say, "Ask him." Anyway, well, it is a magnificent organization, isn't it?
It's a wonderful program, and what I think is important for all of us to realize is how much being able to speak the language, how many doors it opens. Because without that, there's so much you cannot do. And with it, you can get jobs, you can communicate, you can meet people that you've never met. Language is we all rely on it to an incredible degree. And of course, for an adult to learn a new language is not like it is for a kid. You really do need tutors and help. And that's why this is such a fantastic program, because you've got really dedicated people who are volunteering their time and their friendship and their care to make things possible for people in this country. And it couldn't be more wonderful. It's the most, you know, to me as an immigrant, it's the most American thing one can do.
Well, now that you've opened up the door, let me go there. There does seem to be a anti-immigrant portion of the population these days. You're an immigrant. My father was an immigrant.
Yes.
Your wife is an immigrant. Does this strike fear into your soul?
I wouldn't say fear, but a certain kind of despair.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's there seems to be a disconnect between that kind of rhetoric and the kind of warmth and openness that I encounter when I travel. I travel around the country all the time to perform. I go to Texas, I go to Arizona, I go to Colorado, I go to a lot to Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia. I meet the most wonderful people who care so much, who want to do good things, who are open to everything. And yet, when you see the political rhetoric, it doesn't seem to reflect what I see, you know, on the ground. And that to me is very unfortunate. It's very sad. I think if you talk to someone in a personal way, you know, if you meet someone who, let's say, believes in these slogans of immigrants out, if you actually talk to them about a particular person that they've met, that they know that might be undocumented or might have just come over, I'm sure they would say, oh, no, I don't mean him. You know, I do feel that there is a disconnect between the rhetoric and the people I meet, if that makes any sense to you.
Makes great sense to me, which brings me back to your own childhood. Do you ever remember discrimination? Anybody discriminating against you? I mean, I can remember walking down the street in Fire Island where my family had a house and somebody yelling, one of those epithets at me. And I wonder, have you ever experienced any of that?
I must say no. I've had a very sheltered life in that sense. I think my parents experienced, you know, bad times. They both lived through the war in Poland. They both lost all their families. My mother and my father were married before, lost their mates and married after the war. So they certainly had their share, but I never have. I haven't encountered it in a personal way. I know it's there sometimes, and I read, I know what happens, but I personally have not been, I've been fortunate.
That's wonderful. Other than classical music, do you enjoy any other kind of music?
Oh, yes. I love jazz.
Do you?
Yeah, I listen to a lot of jazz pianists, actually. Chief among them, I have to say, Oscar Peterson and Andre Previn. He's one of the great musicians in every way. He does it all. I've done a lot of playing with him, you know, in classical repertoire, and his jazz playing is extraordinary. His composing, I mean, he's a man of a master. How do you say, a jack of all trades and a master of all, one could say.
Yeah. Who are your other classical heroes?
Do you mean performers or composers?
Take your pick. I mean, I've heard 1,000 people talk about Clara Schumann, for example, and what
of course.
To do.
But of course.
Who are yours?
Well, I suppose of the people I heard live, you know, as far as pianists, I suppose from my generation, the people you would always hear about are Horowitz, Rubinstein, Rudolf Serkin. And to me, Van Cliburn, he was a great, great hero for me because we were still behind the Iron Curtain when he won the Tchaikovsky competition in 1958. We were still in Warsaw, and he was unbelievably popular. You can't imagine the kind of hysteria. If anybody cared about music, everybody knew his name more than anyone's. And he was such a great pianist and a wonderful man. So he was a great hero. But, you know, sort of for my generation, Horowitz, Rubinstein, Serkin, Richter, Gilels, the young Pollini, the young Ashkenazi, and always the young Martha Argerich. She's now, I think, 75, and she's just as young as ever. She hasn't changed at all.
Have you performed in Israel?
Oh, yes, I go to Israel pretty regularly. Yeah.
What's that like?
Well, it's a lot of work because you play a lot of concerts night after night after night. You know, the Israel Philharmonic has a series in Tel Aviv of, I think, 5 or 6 concerts, a series in Haifa of 3 concerts, a series in Jerusalem. So, and you do all those, you know, you go for 2 weeks and just play every night. It's amazing. You know, you meet an incredible range of people and an incredible range of political opinion, and everyone will tell you exactly what they think.
Yeah, it's great
at length.
Yeah.
So that's, but that's fine. It's very, you know, it's a very, very vital and vital, voluble, and volatile society, one could say.
Emmanuel Axe, when you look out in the audience and see a lot of gray hair, does that worry you?
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, it would be nice to get more young people in. On the other hand, I have gray hair myself now.
Me too.
So I think everything is changing a bit. Well, demographics are changing a bit, aren't they? There are a lot of white-haired people that are still very vital, and they're doing a lot of things. So I would like to think that first of all, they'll be around for a long time. And I do think that we also, I think for a while, we didn't pick up the slack. The music community, myself included, I don't think we thought much about what we have to do to improve music education because schools were doing much less. And I think now maybe we've turned the corner a little bit. You know, people like Yo-Yo and people like Lang Lang are doing fabulous things with getting music to more young people. And I think that will pay off in audiences later on. That's my impression. I think it's something that we have to think about all the time. There are a lot of very thoughtful and very, very active people doing this. And I hope we'll continue in that direction and that it will happen.
In Yoko's country, of course, in Japan, they seem to have had more success.
Yeah. It's there in China, things seem to be very much on the right track. But, you know, I'm hoping that things will continue to change here, too. We have some young conductors. We have people like Yo-Yo, Lang Lang, but also people like Gustavo Dudamel, who are inspiring a lot of kids, who I hope will become the future audience.
When you think about your choice of piano, do you ever think, boy, I wish I could play the clarinet that as well as I play the piano?
Not really. I'm very happy playing the piano. You know, you can always play by yourself. You don't really need anyone to accompany you.
Right.
And I think that's very nice. You know, the only thing you need is that big black box.
So have you ever found yourself in a string quartet with a string quartet or a quartet, and there's a guy there or a woman there who really just isn't cutting it? Do you ever, you're a nice man. Everybody knows that about you. But what do you want to do? Do you want to stay, you stink? I mean, how do you do it?
Gosh, can I tell you honestly?
Yes.
It's really never come up.
I told you were a nice man.
I think if it ever did come up, you just do what you do and maybe make a note that the next time you get asked to do that, maybe you say you're busy.
What are you going to play at the Mahewi Benefit?
I'm playing some Mozart and a couple of short list pieces and a Beethoven sonata, the Waldstein sonata.
And how did you come upon that? I mean, did you decide this is what
people...
This
is a program I did at Carnegie. And so I tried it out at Carnegie Hall, and it should be ready for Mahewi.
I would think. The Mahewi Theater itself is such a miracle, isn't it? It's just so
beautiful. It's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful place. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, we've been talking with world-renowned pianist Emmanuel Axe performing a benefit concert for the Literacy Network of Southern Berkshire County at the Mahewi Theater on Saturday, May 26th at 7:30 p.m. You can find out much more by going to mahewi.org. Emmanuel Axe, thank you so much for giving us all this time. I know how busy you are. I know you've got to run around and play at other places, and we really appreciate it. It's been a great honor.
It's a pleasure. It's so nice to talk to you. Thank you. We hear you all the time, and we read you all the time. So thank you for that. Keep it up. Thank you.
been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.